and the antenna was missing for the one I can carry around. I get a new one for the break so I can move a bit more around, but I have to stay around the microphone, otherwise it will not be recorded. And I got a question. I got a question last week about the recording, about the audio recording. Somebody told me that they could not hear the sound, but we have checked it out. The technician have reported back to me that they should all be okay now. So let it run a little bit before you turn it off, basically. It should be okay, although the last third week may still be 1 or 2 days before it actually is fully uploaded. That is one practical thing. I have put on self-test and self-question and their answers. You will find them on Blackboard. I put them on this morning, so that should be there for you this weekend if you like to test yourselves. And then a few more practical issues regarding the multiple choice test. Hi guys, we started. Okay, these are some practical things here. I now check this with our learning team, and what we will do a mock multiple choice feedback test on Friday the 28th of October. Friday the 28th of October, that's opening it up next Friday, and it will then run for at least 10 days, meaning at any one time from when it opened, you can check the few questions I have put forward for you. I say 5, there may be 9. The point is not the questions here. The point is, you will see the type of questions, but the more important thing is that it's getting the trust to the system, or the trust in the systems. So you know that you can operate this when the choice test is taking place on Friday, 11th of November. So I said, it's just for you to check in, and the system will give you an automatic response in terms of whether you're right or wrong. Okay? And then, on the 11th, as I said, we plan to open, they would like to do, or cert coordination and knowledge to insurance that they will work effectively. They will use whatever resources has in terms of how much you think it will cost, but it will be to coordinating it to ensure that you meet those goals. So this is about concerned with allocation. Who will perform what tasks? Who is doing what? It is concerned with coordination of effort of a number of people. And you can see that for the Olympics, definitely. And it's concerning the resources you need in order to achieve those goals. And of course, those resources can be of many time here. It could be the people you need, the money you need, the times you need. All those things need to be thought of. Now, in terms of organization, we normally talk about the formal organization. And most of what I'm going to talk about here today is the formal organization. But organization is also about informal organization. Can you think of anything that could be informal organization? You know the word, the grapevine? That's a very kind of British word, and it may not be translated so easy, but what does the grapevine mean? Louder? Yes, it is what people tell each other. It is what is the informal thing that people chat. Information run, outside the formal chain of information. Outside that, people talk together. People talk within department and across unit. So things does come down, communicate, people do communicate. And there is kind of, informal organizations in place, so to speak. But what we are focusing on, what we want to get right, is the more formal organization. In doing that, we are going to talk about a number of things today. First of all, I'm going to start off with focusing on job design. And in that, within job design, I'm going to talk about some general issues we need to clarify up front. Then on ergonomics, I'm going to say something about the way we organize work in terms of working schedules. There are different ways of actually working in terms of time allocation. We're going to talk about team working. How teamwork is different from working as an individual, so to speak, and the kind of advantages and also the disadvantages of team working and how teams actually are operating. Then we are going to work a bit on going through the different organizational structure we actually may have, how organizations may be structures in terms of lines of coordination, lines of communication, how authority is actually divided between people. And we have different forms of structure which we like to look at, looking at what they're like and their strength and their weaknesses. These are the things we're going to do today. I pointed up a couple of things here about other things here about particularly organizational change. And certainly, I will not cover that today. You can find that in chapter 6 in the book of Mike Smith. Anyway, let's get started with job design. So what is job design? Looking at this picture here, this gives you a kind of an insight, very brief one, into a car factory. You see a car factory, a kind of an assembly plant, where the different parts of a car is put together. Now, increasingly, this is now happening with robots, but robots can't do all the job, so I still involve the mixture of robot and people. And the division of labor, the job design in this sense here, is concerned with, number one, what people are required to do as part of their job. So what each individual person is supposed to do, and if you look back at the car factory, that would be like some people have the job of maybe putting on the wheels, checking the wheels, ensuring that the windscreen wipers are on, ensuring the engine, everything is fitted together. But it's a specialized job. So somebody, the exact part of the job, so somebody is carrying out. And then we have specialization, division of labor. Each worker only does part of what is needed to make a product and deliver a service or complete a task. So it is about who does what. So who does what in order for the entire product to be completed on time. Those two factors are the main thing we need to bear in mind when we're talking about job design. There are also a couple of things we need to bear in mind here. The advantages of specialization is one of those I would like to draw attention to. The very fact that people do particular jobs. People are assigned very specific jobs. As I said, specializing may be of a quite limited amount of work using a limited amount of skills. What an advantage there is, for example, is that you can develop skills quickly and therefore cheaply, because you only need to train people in a limited amount of operation. Putting on a tire, putting on windscreen wipers, or maybe they do both things, but at least it's a limited amount of operation which is repeated again and again. So it is cheap and it can be actually achieved quickly in organizational terms. Then you also can get people, you can employ people who actually have the right aptitude, they have the right kind of abilities, they have the right type of opportunities to learn to be able to carry out a particular job. That means that you can employ some people which you think will be particularly good because they're very good with motoric, they have what you say, they can use their fingers and hands very well. But they may not have this very strong intellect. They may not be intellectually very strong. But they may be very good in particular type of jobs. Whilst other people maybe have different types of skills and can be used maybe to more senior jobs, another type of jobs altogether. We're going to talk much more about this in a later lecture when we talk about selection. Then it is about not wasting any time moving from job to job. That means that if everybody did every job, then of course, first of all, they would need to be trained again and again for the new job. And then by moving from job to job, simply in the car factory, if one person physically moved to the next job, then there could also be literally waste the time between the jobs they were carrying out. Then it means also, with specialization, come a simplification of jobs. What that is, another word for that is de-skilling. The advantages for that, from an employer's point of view, can you think of that? If you really de-skill and make jobs very, very simple, can you see one advantage with that? Yes?
Would it mean that it was quicker to carry out?
It's quicker, definitely.
Cheaper.
It is cheaper, so that means also, of course, that you can employ people cheaper. I'm not saying that you should do that, but I say from an employer's point of view, is that that is a potential for actually saving money on labor cost, because people then don't need very much training, and they don't need much training before they come. You can come out of school at 16 years old and you can do simple jobs. You could be even younger if that was the case, but generally 16 years old, you can do the work. Now, there is another thing here, and there is a problem here with it, and that is that this is not very motivating. Why do you think it's not very motivating? Once more? Yeah, very mechanical, repetitive. You do it again and again, and the feeling of boredom is very close to this. It could be seen as effective in organizational terms, but it's very often, for the individual, seen as very boring. It's also an issue that people don't necessarily take very much pride in their work, because they don't see the final product. We have a word for that, saying that people often feel alienated to what they do. They do something, but they do just a very little part of the big product, and they never see and understand really their role in doing the whole thing. And that also means that people get very distanced from their doing. And certainly this idea of developing pride, that people take pride in doing things really well, paying attention to detail, that is very difficult. And also, you develop very limited understanding of the work process. If you just do a very limited things, you have a tendency to leave what people said in the old days. You leave the brain in the gate of the factory because you don't really need it to screw in some, to do the same thing again and again. There is this thing that actually people stop thinking, stop actually using their intellectual capacity. So that's another demotivating factor we need to be aware of. So what does then, what is it that makes job then motivating? What could you think of makes job motivating?
Enjoyable.
That they are enjoyable, yes, so do you get some satisfaction from them?
Salary.
Salary, absolutely.
Perks. Job perks.
Once more.
Like job perks.
Oh, that there are perks, yes. A similar thing, like, sorry for that. That's absolutely right. Perks, that's something else to put in your pocket. May not be salary, but there may be something else. Maybe an advantage in terms of career, promotion, longer holiday, something, yeah?
Feedback,
good feedback, absolutely essential. People telling you whether you have done a good job or not. And also maybe giving you guidance, also when you do not do such a good job. Because people actually prefer good feedback. But at the same time, when you know you get feedback delivered in a positive, friendly way, but at the same time it points out where you have done wrong, and you see that you can improve yourself, people normally also welcome quite critical, but constructive critical feedback. So there are a number of things. Look at this. First of all, to be motivated, we need to talk about skill variety. Jobs where people have an opportunity to use a number of talents, a number of skills. That's why typical jobs where people very often seem very satisfied is, so compared to the car factory, people who work like in a repair garage, for example, and saying, I do every job. Every car will come in here, we are two or three people, and we can do it all, because we do understand car. We understand the engine, how it works. And even if we do quite a number of things again and again, we still understand the whole job. And there is quite a lot of variety to what we are doing. So that could be, as opposed to compare that with standing in a chocolate factory and putting every day 12 chocolate, one out of each type, into a box. Every day, just ensuring that you get those 12 in. Yeah, you may think the smell of those chocolate is nice in the beginning, but I tell you, you get soon very fed up of it. And that perk you may get to eat as many chocolate as you like, that may actually, when you start on the weight at the end of the month, you may think that's not the nicest of perks. Anyway, task identity is another one here. That is exactly about this issue of alienation, the opposite of alienation, that you actually are part of doing the whole thing. You see the completion of the job. So for example, if you are a cabinet maker, you know, somebody who have really skilled people who can use joining skills, so you know they can work with wood and things like that, they can build cabinets, they can build furniture, they see it all. They are part of everything from the design process to picking the right raw material, they maybe discuss it with the customer, they put it together, they can have all the pride in this and they have a credible identity with what they are doing. That it is task significance. That is how important it is seen your job in societal terms. Meaning, what impact does it have on people's lives? Is your job important to people's life? So for example, if you work as a nurse, if you work as a doctor, if you work as a maybe police constable, some people really feel like there are a number of those jobs, but I feel my job actually matters. But there may be some other jobs for people feeling that my job is not worth that much. It's not really very important that I do this job. So that also then is demotivating. Autonomy. What does the word autonomy mean? Independence. Good point. The more. Another word starting with C. Control. So autonomy, independence, absolutely right, but that feeling of being in control, the feeling of freedom, like you're saying, to that actually you can monitor yourself. Maybe that autonomy is simply that you can decide on how you are doing the job. It may not be that you have autonomy whatever you do, so you have to come to work and it's very decided that you are going to do 10 different operations. But how you do each of those 10 operations actually give you some autonomy, how you are carrying it out. Autonomy to take breaks. I tell you, that was a big issue in the past where factories were run in a way that people could not even move away from the assembly line, from the conveyor belt when the products were coming. That actually, the even things like toilet breaks had to be very clearly 10 o'clock, then have to be, just put, cross your legs, your next time is 12 o'clock. But it is more or less like that, maybe sure there were some opportunities there for getting away, but it was really nearly like that. Then you have feedback, and here we can make a distinction between, on the one hand, intrinsic feedback, on the other hand, extrinsic feedback. And intrinsic, you can think of the word, it's something that comes from yourself. It is something, the way the job is carried out. You see the product, the cabinet maker see, wow, I can do this. I do a good job as a nurse. Some of it is that you can just see the smile of the patient's face, or it doesn't have to be a smile. You can know that if you are a nurse who work in a burned unit, the fact that you know that these are the patients with the worst pain nearly of all kind, the fact that you can help them reducing that pain and they appreciate what you are doing, that feeling, that's intrinsic motivation, because the job itself gives you that feeling that it's important that you've done a good job. But then you have the extrinsic feedback was mentioned here, that somebody actually giving you feedback, somebody telling you you did a good job, or the good job, they were good thing, and they were not so good thing. And let us look at both of them, because even the good thing, you may able to be maybe even better. Or you can build on them in order to be improving those you did not do so well. So all those factors, which all come from Hackman and Oldham, it was an old contribution, but a still important one, is important when we talk about job motivation. There are some key factors we need to bear in mind. I will here make a distinction between four, very briefly, because we're going to talk more about them today. And those are making a distinction between authority, empowerment, responsibility, and span of control. And authority, in that sense, is the formal power to make decisions, which actually the job provides you with. Now, of course, the higher up in the organizational hierarchy you are, the more authority you have. So the senior manager has more authority than the middle manager, who have more authority than the supervisor, again, have more authority than their subordinates, those who are, maybe have no supervisory responsibility. But even some people who do not have kind of really high jobs may still have some authority to make decisions within their job. So that is important. So it's the ability, the right to make decisions and also to instruct others. So sometimes it could be that like the university, here we work at Manchester University, could ask me and some colleague to say, you have a particular skills and we would like you on behalf of the university to carry out a particular job. And if we do so, then of course we could be given some authority which we otherwise wouldn't have in order to instruct some other people to help us, for example. We are given that very clearly, that right to do that for a limited task and for a limited amount of time. So it is about that. Empowerment. Well, the words it said here is about pushing authority down the line. Hopefully that people at the lower organizational level getting more right to make decision, getting more right to instruct other, but even people on the lowest level get more rights to make decision in their job life. More control over their own tasks, more control over how they're carrying it out, more control over being involved in the planning of what they are doing. Responsibility about the area or resources for which one has responsibility. So that is the area, defining very clearly, you are responsible for task A, B, C, and D, you for F and G. So you just know, and sometimes you're trying to avoid that you have responsibility for exactly the same thing, because that may be some conflict between people. So it's exact your responsibility, how that is defined. And that is span of control. Do you remember how I defined that? I showed you a way to remember span of control. Anybody remember that? I did. Do you remember I did this? This is what I mean by that. It's not some exercise. I don't know what I know. I probably need this. But what I'm trying to say by this is that these are the number of people. Everybody I can get here under my arms are the people I can directly control. The nature of the job is of such a kind that I am able to control exact number of people because, as I said, I can control many people if the job is relatively simple, so people know what they are doing and they are doing, relatively speaking, the same thing every day. So standardized jobs. So in a factory, the fact that people are standing by a conveyor belt and doing the same thing every day, and there are many people doing it, I can have very many people. So I can probably control 50 people if they're all doing similar and everybody know how they're doing things. If I, for the other way around, if the job is very complex, if the job is difficult in that sense, I can have very few people. So if it's not standardized at all, everybody doing different things, I can only control a few people. Because for everybody I'm going to, I need to think of different things. So I'm looking at you, how you are doing your job, and then I have to take into consideration what your responsibility is, what your tasks are. I move on to you, and you do something else. I need to think of that. But if all of you are doing the same thing, it's much easier for me to move around and have an eye about what you are doing. I don't even have to. I can even control it, not by necessarily being there, but just by looking at some of your output and some doing some spot checks from time to time, things that give me some paid feedback about the quality about your job. So that span of control. So let us bear that in mind. Now I'm going to talk about something else in job design. And what I'm trying to show you here is about how people actually are carrying out their work in kind of physical sense. It is the way we organize people's environment in order for it to be, as you can see here, what do you think? These are, how would you characterize what you see here?
Dangerous.
Dangerous, yes, more? Definitely dangerous. These people here, the likelihood of having an accident is rather large. These is, both these pictures, well, the one, to the, one of them you can see is a rather old picture, but because in the past there were very little attention to doing things in order to reduce accidents. We are more aware of it now, but I tell you, people all the time do stupid things. My brother-in-law actually did the most stupid thing at all, and he is not an unintelligent man, but he had actually got a kind of a motor saw, you know, like, and he wanted to take that kind of motor saw to do something with a tree in his garden. And he did exactly what would absolutely, you think, how can anybody do that? He placed himself on one of the branches, and when he was doing some smaller one, he also saw suddenly a big one, and he took that as well, and it was the one he was sitting at. So he came down with the thing, and he cut it, he had to go to casualty, 16 stitches on his leg, and they said, of course, well, you are a very lucky man, you know, and they said, you are rather stupid, and I think he's right. But people do this thing in their home, but also at work. I just, look, I went down the main street in Seville, Spain, last year, and I saw somebody doing a painting job, and he couldn't reach up. And what he did, he started then to stable up, you know, cans, big cans of paint. And he had like six on top of each other. And he tried to get up to the top one. And he got up and they were just standing like this. And he was standing trying to get the last corner. It was four stories down. But people forget this thing. And this is one aspect of ergonomics. It is about ensuring that jobs are designed so they are suitable for human beings to perform and that harmful effects are minimized. So we're trying to do both of those things, minimizing that they're harmful, but they also that they are as suitable as possible. Let me say how work in this originally actually emerged. And what the reason I'm showing these planes here is that a lot of work into ergonomics emerged during the Second World War. Now, we will become more and more aware that planes and very important core, what do you say, core as members of the armed forces lost their lives. Pilots and planes were lost due to mistakes they did in the decision they make in a fraction of a second was wrong. They made the wrong decision because the airplanes were not constructed in a way which was favorable to operating in very dangerous situations where you have to make this very fast decision. They looked at how they particularly, it was about how they could display all the type of instrument which was necessary for pilots to control in order to operate fast. So it was about the height of the plane, the pace of the plane, the speed of it, and it was about all of those things, and of course how you maneuvered according to where other planes were, according to where your targets were, and in the war, according to where the enemy were. And in order to do that, you needed to have all these instruments put in a way so you actually could make sense of them. And prior to this, there had been no attention to that. They just pushed them in and said, here you can see, here, if you were lucky, there was an instrument. So this is also to develop instrument to give quick feedback to the pilot where they are. So they don't have to say, am I high up? Am I high? Yeah, I think I'm rather high. That they actually can, in the screen, saying that you are 1,914 feet. Because I tell you, just looking down won't really tell you that. The difference between 500 feet and 1,000 feet is not really difficult, easy to spot from a high, big height. So these are important things. So what they then did, ergonomics, or people who help develop an instrument particularly for the war effort, they were the one that started putting in motion a lot of work in this area, leading to the planes look like this today, very, very kind of complex, where the two pilots have incredible overview of what is going on. Every instrument, they can measure it, they can control it, and it's put in the kind of distance to them, which is right. They can see many things at the same time, and they don't have to do silly operation in order to see something. Like, for example, having to turn around and by chance actually hitting the wrong thing so the plane go down when you were supposed to go up. These are also important. Now, this information, this knowledge, can then be used in different ways. It could be used in order to reduce accident, and this is the way it's done in the factory. Is by means of putting in place a lot of what we can call oh, what's the word I'm looking for now? In the Disney, you can see it's boxed in. It's simply to avoid direct contact between people and moving objects, moving dangerous objects. Therefore, you put in all this mechanism, as you can see here, and in factories, particularly in developed countries, this is today, it's a law. We have a health and safety law in this country which require that employer do this thing. This is not always the case in every country. In the less developed country, there will be more dangerous operation. But it's all about making life safer for people. But as you can see here, it's also a making life more in line with how human would like it to be. Now, this picture here is maybe a bit over the top. This person is obviously enjoying him sitting very, very comfortable. But it is about comfortable, something that the work is organized to fit with the need of your body. The need of, physical need of your body, because it's very tough to stand all day. It's very tough to sit in a particular position all day. So for example, a typical thing that's coming in more and more country now in office environment is desks, which are completely hydraulic desks. So you, by means of pushing a button, you can get it to every height you like at any time. And what is it people are encouraged to do then is to maybe some time of the day stop sitting. Sitting is not very healthy. You don't feel it at all when you are 20. But you're getting older, you will know that sitting is not the best thing for you. And maybe you will stand for a part of the day. Literally, so you just push the button, the desk come up here, and I can stand and do exactly my work. And then after 20 minutes, I think I'd rather sit again, and it goes down again. And I could say, in some environment, this is taken even further. God knows what the future will be. But this is about work economics, ergonomics, which is also an aspect of what we can say, job design. Let me move on. Work schedules. This is another thing I'm going to talk about, how we actually design jobs in terms of time, when people are working and for how long time they're working. Do you know what the legal requirement, or put it that way, what the kind of limitation for work is in this country?
60 hours per week.
Wow, you are breaking the law very, very much, but there are a lot of people doing that. 50, you're getting closer.
20.
No, we're closer. I've made a good guesses here. 48. 48, you're allowed to work 48 hours for a consecutive 9 weeks. But after that, you need to reduce it. You cannot work 48 hours forever. There are some exceptions. There are some particular jobs where people are allowed to work longer, like hospital doctors and things like that. But these are set down in the law. And this law is not just for this country. This is an EU directive regulation. So this is for every country a member of the EU. They have to do this. Why do you think that law has come in place? Yeah, you're getting close to it. More reasons. So just please. Protecting people, really good. Efficiency, that is actually to some extent right. Some people think that there's nothing to do with efficiency and all to do with protection. I think protection probably came first. But efficiency is another reason. It's some people think that the longer you work, the more you get on. But that's not always the case. There's a lot of research also showing that not reducing it to 1 hour per week, but reducing it, maybe certainly not working 60 hours per week, is actually more effective in the long run, because people do get tired. And what do they do when they get tired? They make mistakes, the quality goes down, and so on. And then, of course, there may have more accidents as well. So effectiveness, and that may be another issue. It could also be an issue of competition, an issue of so-called creating a level playing field. You know the football pitch that is leveled, so we are all playing the same games. So it's not allowed in one country for people to work 60 hours and another country in Europe to allow to working only 35 hours. Because that would mean that it would be very unfair competition between the countries, and capital would tend to move to where maybe people will be allowed to work for longer hours. So that is another reason for it. Now, when we talk about job design, It's not just particular about the number of working hours, but within those hours, how they actually are spent. How are we actually working? So look at the first time here, it's flexi time. Anybody tell me what flexi time is? Open hand, flexi time, but sure, because I can't move to you, so it's like, yeah, please. Yeah.
You don't work like the whole time, but you actually split it
into. No, normally not, but you are right in the first thing. You have some control, flexi time, meaning normally that you can flex for a part of the day. Normally, organization operate what they would call core hours. That means that everybody has, for example, to be at work from 10 to 2 o'clock. And then you can decide whether you would like to, for example, start at 7. And move, and then leave at 3:30, for example, or 4 o'clock, or whether you will start at 10 and leave at 6 o'clock, depending on, so you do the right number of hours. So you can flex in the kind of, in one part of the day or another. Can you see advantages with that? Yes? Absolutely, school and things like that. So that, and also for a job, it may be quite good because it means that we actually have people working for a longer time, using equipment, using, and also even towards customers, that there may be people picking up phones even in the evening and early on. But for the organization, at the same time, important to have those core hours where everybody is around. So that's important from an organization point of view as well. What I think you particularly looked at, there's something called split shifts. It's actually, it's used quite a lot like in the hotel and catering industry, whereby people may be coming in, particularly working when it's very busy. So some people coming in the morning when guests are checking out from the hotel room, when you need a lot of work, and maybe then later in the day when you need it again. Now that could be sometimes also very practical around family life, although it is quite frustrating because it means that you're nearly always working when it's very busy. So it kind of could be quite stressful. Do you see what I mean? You are picking up the peak time altogether. What about compressed time? Well, the work here, not you so much, but some in some industries, is allowed to work your week of fewer days. So instead of working a 48-hour work, 8 hours per day, you actually work 10 hours over 4 days, and then you have 3 days free in the weekend, for example. Or you may have another shift routine, but it is about compressing your hours to one end of the week and then having more time off. Again, it's used very much in some industries, particularly where people have to commute. So they feel that, you know, when many people, the workers, are living quite far away, then they feel they need more time around family life and doing their own private life. So then that may be quite practical. Then we have the issue of home working and teleworking. So again, what is that? Yes, it is very, yeah, you need not a $10,000 question, that one, I do agree. It is working from home. It does mean that you are, of course, linked up, as tele suggests, by one mean, for example, by your computer, to the activities of the organization. So in a way, you can align your jobs with that of other people. And you can, of course, so this is, can you see the advantages with that? Yes? Yes, that's very good, and it stops also people clogging up the motorway. Good point to me. What?
Cheaper?
Yes, it could be cheaper. Why?
Because you don't need to rent.
Exactly. Oh, sorry, wait a second, you please.
More
employee friendly, because you can combine it. Like you said earlier on, we like family life and things like that. And would you, was that what you're going to say? Yes, so you save office space. There are a lot of win both for the employer and potentially for the employees. Please.
But you should say, like, there's more potential because they may work
some time of the day. Yeah, that's true. Absolutely. People feeling, I'm really good at working early on in the morning. Actually, I'm good at 5 o'clock in the morning. Not you. None of you. But there are some people who actually are good in the morning, right? And some of you may be good in the evening. But that is before you take a drink. That doesn't count. But what I mean here, no, what I mean seriously, is that people, I like your point here. Can you see some disadvantages? Yes, it could be that people don't, and reason, don't take it so seriously because they don't see really the big difference between sitting with their legs up at the table reading a magazine and doing their job, for example, possible. Yeah?
Not a lot of supervision.
Yes, there is very difficult with supervision. I take that point.
The work might not be punctual, like it won't be done in time.
Yes, so exactly, and partly because of that supervision, for maybe, yeah? Exactly. So you do totally rely on the communication here, right? That this is all up and working all the time. Another thing is that for the person themselves, it could be that they lose a little bit touch with what is work and what is private life. And people can, over time, feel that they're always working. You know, they're always working. It's all but kind of a, they're not very good in saying, I'm now working and I'm now having time off. They're doing a little bit of work all the time, so they find themselves working for 12 hours, putting in their stuff. And that could be also problematic. And sometimes that could interfere with home life, irritate the family. So while there's big potential advantages, it could also be disadvantages. Contingent worker. This refers to workers who actually are not permanently employed in the organization. Organizational workers or people who are taken aboard for a shorter or longer time to help out. Can you see some advantage with that? Yes. Say something more about that.
It saves you, like, if a teacher's not sick, you know, someone can look after the
class. Yes. Exactly. It's save of when somebody, for example, are sick, so there is that opportunity. People using, for example, agency as temporary workers. It's not always cheaper for the organization, but it can be cheaper if you take into consideration everything involved with employing new people. So certainly that could be cost saving on the way here. So contingent worker in the end is very often used for that reason, because the organization doesn't need to give commitment in the long run. Maybe they feel they don't need that job for a very long time, so they'd rather take on somebody on a more looser relationship. They don't have given them a permanent contract, therefore the shorter time. You can see disadvantages for the persons here. You can see that for the people who are employed, that means that quite often that they really don't have security. They don't know, you know, they may, well, particularly if that is an open-ended, they don't know what will their next job be. So they may have a job for 2 months, but what happened after that? Very often contingent workers are looking for more permanent jobs. But some people are happy, because they can combine it with family life and with other things they're doing, studying, for example. Now, office sharing is one thing that's come up recently. And that is simply, you can imagine yourself what office sharing is, that meaning that several people are using the same office. What's the advantage with that? It is... Yes, it does. So you do, but know that I take that point. Other things?
Cheaper.
Definitely cheaper, because you actually can utilize the space. So you need less space, because the same space is actually shared by several people. A different here would be job sharing. So please make a distinction between job sharing and office sharing. Job sharing means, for example, that two people... For example, that happened quite a lot at the university. People very often who have been on maternity leave, they've had a baby, then they often, and it's mostly women, but it's not only women, they decide want to be maybe for the next few years, spend some more time with the kids or difficulties to, they want to be home when the kids come from school and things like that. And for that reason, two people actually share a job. One work maybe 2.5 days in the beginning of the week, the other one work 2.5 days at the end of the week. The final one I'm going to mention here now, before we have a break, is actually hoteling. And hoteling is, well, it's not really about hotels. Do anybody know what it is? Well, hoteling is basically... Treating is the same thing as some kind of shared office space. It means that an organization very often rent some place where people can come in and work, where there are facilities available. For example, people who do a lot of traveling in their jobs. So when they then come into a city, large company may then have an office where they can go in and using all the equipment which is there. So they may use computers, they may use access to secretaries and all that kind of thing. So that may be one way of saving time, saving money for the organization, and at the same time, it link the individual worker to the organization when they are traveling. They are still in touch with the organization, which may be a strength of this. But what the way it operates is that you will have to book in time to this facility, telling when you are coming, and if you're coming regular to a place. So for example, you very often, you are a representative of a company like Boeing, or you know, a big company, and you all the time do traveling. So every time you are in London, every time you are in Chicago, New York, you actually book into these places, and you may even have a box which is yours with some of your personal belongings, some of your thing you're going to use and need for your job, actually locked away, numbered, so you can pick it up here. Could be a trolley sometimes with all your private things, and you just move it into the office space you have booked. It may vary. One day you get room number 103, the next time you get room number 108, but it's cheap and it's effective. So that's even another way of working. Now we have covered a number of areas of job design. When we are coming back after the break, we take 10 minutes now, we are going to move on talking about another way of working, namely team working.